Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience. Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me for the first time in 2012 is Diane Alston, the extension entomologist at Utah State University. And if you'd like to join our conversation, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can join us through your email question by going to upr.org, clicking on programs, and then see the Access Utah link from that point. Diane, thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Happy spring.
Well, when I see you, I know that it's very, very close time for me to get out in the garden and get something planted. So that's positive
for me. So that means
I bring you joy.
Bring you a good feeling. That's great. Yeah. It was such a lovely weekend. It was great to get out in the garden a bit.
Well, so what are you seeing outside? What's starting to move? Literally, my first insect was a little butterfly that I saw yesterday.
Yeah, there were a few butterflies out this weekend. Also saw a couple honeybees. So that was, again, very encouraging that we're getting into some nice enough days that the bees are becoming active.
They're not finding anything.
Well,
I haven't seen any flowers other than my little snowdrops.
Right. Some of the early things, really, really early things we may not notice so much, but when pussy willows start to bloom, which I haven't seen any blooming yet, but that's one of the early flowers that I see the bees just really drawn to those because there's just so little out there for them to eat that when they start, it's a big attraction. Not a lot of insect activity out in the garden yet. Probably more things indoors. You were mentioning in the opening about some of the insects that have come into our homes over the winter, seeing more of those kinds of things right now. But I expect after a couple more weeks of nice weather or getting into longer days that we'll start to see more things active outdoors.
Well, let's start right out with dormant oil, because I know that there are some areas in the southern part of the state. I have no idea how far along they are, but they're going to be coming up pretty quick.
They're probably already getting very close. So just to the first thing I always think about when I look out at my fruit trees, when I can finally get outdoors and start doing things, is it's time to get them pruned if you haven't already. So that's the first thing you want to do before you apply your dormant oil for sure. Most of our fruit trees, it's best to wait until what we call a delayed dormant timing, and that is right at bud break. You know, so the buds are swollen and you can see the tissue inside getting ready to pop out, and that's right at the time when you want to put on your dormant oil, as we call that the delayed dormant oil. And the reason for that is that what you're doing is you're suffocating insects and mites that have overwintered on the limbs of the tree, and their timing of activity is very closely tied to that of the tree. And so as soon as those buds start to pop, that's when those aphid eggs are hatching, when the European red mite eggs start to hatch. So if you put that oil on right at that time, you're getting the most efficacy. That is, they're starting to breathe, respirate, and that you're doing the suffocating them by coating them with the oil. So that's the most effective time. There is an exception to that, and that is for pear trees. There's an insect called the pear scilla, which is a small sap-feeding insect that creates a lot of sticky honeydew. And it can actually cause the pear leaves to turn quite brown.
Is that the one that looks like a little slug on the leaves?
Well, that's something different.
Oh, okay.
That's called the pear slug, pear and cherry slug.
Okay.
So yet a different one. That one doesn't tend to show up till later in the summer. But the pear scilla, the adults overwinter. And as soon as this time of year, you know, a month before bloom, they start to move back into the pear trees. They're attracted by the odors they can pick up from them, and they'll lay their eggs starting now. And so with pear trees, it's best if you've had problems with this sticky honeydew-producing insect in the past that you put on a true dormant spray with your oil. And that would be generally in the northern part of the state, that's about mid-March. Down south, you're already past that timing. So
you do it before you put on
the
delayed dormant.
Right. And then with pear, we typically would put on both a full dormant spray, so like now or in the next week, put on that oil for the persilla, and then you would put on another oil again just when the buds start to open.
So what are you looking for? So that the buds are swelling, are you looking for the first just little bit of color of the blossoms, but
right.
not yet open?
That's exactly right. You don't want to spray oil on open blossoms because you will damage the blossoms and then not get the pollination. So you want to do it before that flower opens. But cutting it as close as you can, waiting until you see a little bit of that either pink or white flower tissue starting to show. Because again, that's when the insects are becoming active. And so you'll get the best knockdown of those overwintering insects.
Now, what if you have a tree that has gone into every other year bearing and you don't necessarily mm-hmm. see any blossoms? Are you just looking for a little bit of green?
A little bit of green. And apple, too, the leaf buds open before the flower buds. And so with apple, you'll see the green first. And you can apply the oil up to what we call about a green tip, which is where you've got up to maybe about a quarter inch of green tissue showing without any harm. The leaves are more tolerant of the oil than are the flowers.
And so the whole idea with this is just to coat the tree enough so that
right.
it's actually dripping and encasing the branches, not the trunk, but the branches
right.
with this oil.
Yeah, so the goal, the objective is to coat the limbs from the what we call the scaffold, or the main scaffolding limbs. So you have the lower trunk, which is the straight down part, and then where the limbs start to branch off, we call those scaffolding limbs. And so you want to coat the limbs from that point upward. And usually the oil doesn't drip off because it's a little more viscous than is a more
okay.
watery spray. But what you'll see is you'll turn the limbs a darker color because as you put that oil on, it causes it to darken up. And the primary location where these different insect eggs are laid is on the undersides of the limbs. And they purposely do that because it's more protected from the winter elements. You can imagine snow coming down. If you're on the underside of a branch, your little eggs are a little more protected. Also, right around buds, so we call those bud scales, where there's little tissue where the buds are going to emerge from, little cracks and crevices. Those are all prime places for eggs to be laid.
So what insects are we looking at that this takes care of?
Okay, so pretty much all of the aphids that attack fruit trees. So in apples, we've got a couple different kinds. There's the rosy apple aphid, the green apple aphid. In peaches, we have the green peach aphid. In our sweet cherry trees, we have the black cherry aphid. So all of those overwinter as eggs on the limbs. Also, I mentioned the persilla, which moves in this time of year, the adults do, or in the north. Again, the south, we're probably already well past the dormant timing there. They're getting close to delayed dormant timing. So persilla, but also the European red mite overwinters as eggs on the tree.
So tell me about mixing this stuff up. How easy is it to prepare and to spray, and how toxic is it?
The dormant oil is just, it's a petroleum-based oil. It's just like basically taking your motor oil that you put in your car, but refining it much more so that it becomes lighter. It's not quite clear. It's maybe more of a little off, you know, off-white or to slightly yellow color, but it's very lightweight. It almost looks like vegetable oil or something like that, but it's a petroleum oil. It's not difficult to mix. You just follow the instructions on the label. You're generally putting on between 2-4% oil for the volume of water that you add. And just make sure it is mixed well. It stays in solution quite well, and then apply that with a sprayer. And there's many different kinds of sprayers you can use. If you have a good number of fruit trees, it's probably worth it to invest in some kind of a sprayer that has a little motor on it, an electric pump or something. If you just have a few trees, you may not want to go to that expense. And so you can use like a pump-up backpack kind of sprayer or a canister type of sprayer.
And those are enough to keep the oil mm-hmm. diffused within the water. And
right. And just, it's okay. always good if it's on your back. When I do backpack spraying, you know, you just kind of shake it around to keep it in solution. Or if it's in a canister style, you can just shake it up every so often.
And what do we look for in the store? What does it just say? Usually dormant
usually
oil
spray.
Usually
just says dormant oil. There's you know, many different brands. If you're not familiar with dormant oil, I always advise people to go to a garden store that has you know, service, so people that know things about their products, at least when you're first trying to find a new product, and you know, ask for some help, and they can certainly direct you to it. But it just says dormant oil on it.
And so what you're buying is the oil, and then you mix that with the water.
So you dilute it. So again, 2-4% is the typical range.
Does using a surfactant ever help? And I know I do this with my insect pesticide.
I wouldn't add it with your oil. Oil can be somewhat sensitive to mixing with some kinds of other insecticides or surfactants. With oil, you just—it's pretty much just
it's
straight
gonna cling
oil
on its own,
right? Because, as you know, oil is what it does. It's a viscous material, and it will do a good job of coating the surface that you apply it to. So you don't need any surfactant with oil. Surfactants are more beneficial when you're trying to get good coverage on foliage of with an insecticide or fungicide.
And if anyone's wondering what a surfactant is, spreader sticker
is
one of those names.
Yep.
Okay, so if this were to be put on a scale of most important to least important gardening activities in your garden for the year, where would you rank dormant oil spray?
If you have experienced problems with aphids, red spider mites, oh, and I neglected to mention another very important one. If you have peach trees, not so much here in Cache Valley. We don't tend to have as much of this insect called the peach twig borer as along the Wasatch
Front. Thank goodness.
You see a little bit of it, but not like you do if you go down to Ogden, Layton, you know, Salt Lake area and so forth. That also is controlled with that delayed dormant oil spray applied to peach trees because they overwinter as little larvae in these little cells on the twigs. And so that oil does the same thing. It coats them and suffocates them. So if you've had problems with any of those insects in the past on your fruit trees, I would say the delayed dormant oil is one of the top priority. And reasons are, it's very, you know, I didn't address your question earlier about safety or, you know, it's a very safe product to use. Its mode of action is by suffocation and on these small insects and insect eggs and mite eggs. So
it's not toxic to other beneficial insects unless you spray it on the trunk, because there are some beneficials on the trunk.
There are some beneficials on the trunk, but most of the beneficials are not out yet. It's too early. So that way they're protected. And we don't advise that you spray down on the lower trunk. And the reason for that is that our primary predatory mite, called the Western Orchard Predatory Mite, overwinters there on the trunk in the cracks and crevices. So that's why we say start at that main, the tree crotches, where the scaffolding limbs come off and up above that. And they're mostly going to be on the younger wood. Primarily wood that was, limbs that were grown in the last couple years, and that's going to be up higher in the canopy, not down at the base.
Now, after you have sprayed with these, or with this delayed dormant oil, how likely is it that if your neighbor hasn't sprayed, that you're going to get insects moving in from their trees to yours, even though you've sprayed?
Well, there are some insects, that is true, the ones that are like moths and flies that can fly. So if your neighbor isn't doing anything to control coddling moth, for example, the primary worm pest of apples
and
pears.
And I'm not casting aspersions here.
Yes, I understand.
Not my own neighbors.
then it's very true. What your neighbor's doing in his or her apple tree can affect yours. But with these overwintering insects that we're targeting with our delayed dormant oil spray, that's not so much the case, at least not the early on populations, because they're hatching from eggs. They're at that stage. They're young. They're not flying. So they're only moving by means of crawling, and so those early infestations are coming just from what was present on your tree, and the same with your neighbor's tree. Later on, when they get to adults and the populations develop wings and they start to fly to other trees and hosts, then there might be some cross interaction there, but not early on.
But their populations won't be nearly as large if you don't spray. I mean, I'm not going to have the same populations of this, is it rosy apple?
Aphid.
Aphid. Mm-hmm. as I would have if I didn't spray, because I'm going to get maybe a few that might fly in from elsewhere. But if I've seen problems in the past, it's probably my own problem.
That's right. That's right. And if you really want to really get into this, take a little magnifying lens, or what we call hand lens, and go out, and you can actually see these eggs. They look like they're about quarters to third the size of a grain of rice. So get an idea of the size. They're quite small. Most of them tend to be pretty dark in color. So black is the most common color. Sometimes they can be kind of a dark olive green as well, depending on the species. But most of them are black.
Sounds like a good Cub Scout thing to do for the bears or the wolves.
Yeah.
I'm a cub master, so that's sounds pretty good.
You have your troop come out and check out your fruit trees and see if they're seeing any aphid eggs.
Well, you're listening to Access Utah. Diane Alston, USU's extension entomologist, is in studio for the rest of the hour. If you have any questions or comments, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or go online to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then you'll see Access Utah and can email us your question that way. So what else should we be concerned about for outside? Sounds like the delayed dormant oil spray is the biggest thing right now.
The biggest thing I think that's coming up, certainly once you start getting some of your cooler season vegetables in or coming up, then there's some different insects that come onto the scene. One of the early insect problems can be the cutworm, which is a caterpillar, a moth larva that will come along and chew off the young seedlings as they pop out of the soil, and you almost want to swear that somebody went out there with a pair of scissors and cut down your beans or whatever. So it can be a problem when we get to that point. We start to have some of the cooler season crops starting to come up.
And I know flea beetle has been a problem on certain greens in my garden. I'm trying to think. Usually it's the arugula.
Arugula, and they like chard very well. It's another one. Beets. If you're growing your beets for greens, that can be a problem. I have all these little like shot hole looking holes in them, and those are the adults feeding on the greens. Also, another early one is the leaf miner, and those are little serpentine trails that you see on the leaves, the surface of the leaves, and that's a fly that the larva is inside making that little mine. So those are all early season pests. So one general recommendation to help with those is to use what we call plant fabric or row cover fabric. It's that very lightweight, but yet fairly strong kind of cloth that you can buy at gardening stores. It comes in usually in a roll, and so you can roll out pieces of it and use some stones or something to secure around the edges so it doesn't blow away. And that can help deter some of these early season pests from finding your young plants. And sunlight goes through it. You just have to keep it loose enough that you're not deterring, the growth of the plants. But early on, when there's those young, tender leaves, that's the time you want to especially protect them.
So these are insects that are flying in. They're not necessarily coming from the soil in your garden.
They do, but so that's a good question. It's really best to move things around in your garden. So for example, if you had a spinach in a certain part of your garden last year and you saw a lot of the leaf miner, for example, it's a fly, and the pupae, which is the resting stage, do go into there in the soil. But if you move your spinach to just another area of the garden this year, then they'll emerge from the old spinach area and they'll have to fly and move onto your new spinach. So by moving things around like that, you can help keep the populations down. Flea beetles are a little bit harder because they have such a wide host range. It's the things we just talked about, the arugula, some of the early greens. It's also potatoes and even tomatoes. And so it's a little harder to rotate all those things. But still, covering them with the early plants with plant fabric does seem to help.
Well, and this would be an advantage, too, if you either till or spade certain areas.
Yes.
That will disturb the soil.
Definitely.
and take care of some of those.
And it's best if you can, after you're finished with your garden in the fall, to get in a tillage then. because what that does is it brings up these insect pupae in overwintering stages. It stirs them up. It brings them up higher to the surface often, where they'll be exposed to the cold, and or the soil might dry out, and they dry out. So you get a little more effect if you can even do that tillage in the fall. Even if you plant a cover crop for the winter, that's fine. If you till, then plant your cover crop. And then if you till again in the spring, then that's great. You'll get more benefit to that than just letting it sit over the whole winter before you till.
Now, here's a question I hadn't thought about before. Would a cover crop of any kind affect the populations?
Yes. And so research has shown that cover crops in the mustard family, especially when they're growing, there are some exudates coming out of the roots, but the real benefit you get is in the spring when you disc in or till in the green vegetation that's grown there. That releases a lot of isothiocyanates, a particular compound. So like when you eat plants in the mustard family, you know that you get that kind of zingy taste, and that's part of these isothiocyanates. And they can be detrimental to insects and other organisms that are in the soil.
Cyanates, is that related to cyanide?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's okay for us to ingest the plant, of course.
Right, but it's not harmful if we consume it.
But it's in small enough or large enough quantities for the insects that it takes care of them.
Right, so that there's recommendations that we use different kinds of mustard cover crops to help with if you're trying to target some insect problems in the soil.
We have our first caller. We have from Cedar City, Susie calling. Hi, Susie. How can we help?
Good morning. I called last week, so I'm doing it 2 days in a row.
Two weeks in a row.
First off, allergies are terrible so far. I was watching Natural Weather, and they were saying that allergies and insects are going to be really bad because it was the fourth warmest winter on record in lots of the parts of the United States. I know the mosquitoes are really bad in New Orleans already, but I've already killed two here in Cedar City, and my son did just 10 miles north of us. So the mosquitoes are out already down south here. And we're high, in Cedar, we're mile high up here. So I'm just surprised it's that early. My question has to do with fruit trees. I have a couple that I didn't get in the ground last year that are still in their buckets. And I'm wondering, they've got kind of wild, if I should just plant them and not prune them back yet, or if it's okay to go ahead and plant them now, if I should wait till we get a little warmer and things start budding. I'm just wondering when's the best time to put these in the ground. I'm going to have to be gone a lot of the summer. I won't be able to tend them much. So I'm just looking for the right time to put fruit trees in the ground that should have been planted last year.
Okay.
I'll hang up and listen to you.
Okay.
Thanks, Susie.
Those are all good questions. Let me first comment on your first comment about the warmer winter. And yes, we did have a mild winter.
And not much snow cover.
So, but it's always so variable. It's hard to make sweeping generalizations. Some insects populations are going to be higher because of the mild winter, no doubt. But then yet others that might have still experienced enough cold without much snow cover in some areas might actually be less. So it's hard to make, again, sweeping generalizations. But on average, I would say that, yes, we're probably poised for a high population insect year because of the relatively mild winter. The question about the fruit trees, the first thing you want to be sure when you overwinter trees in pots above ground is that you don't let the roots, freeze too much. It's usually better to try to what we call hill them in, where you can pile some soil up around the root ball, either inside the pot or outside the pot, however works best. And that just helps keep the roots ball from completely freezing. So hopefully her trees are still in good health. She can really plant a containerized fruit tree as soon as she can work the soil, as soon as it's thawed out enough that she can dig down and make that nice hole to put it in. You want to make sure when you're planting a fruit tree that the scion, which is where the above ground part was grafted on to the root stock, and you can see that because there's this bumpy area there where that graft union occurs. You want to make sure that's above ground. You don't want that to be down in the soil.
Is that for both stone and apples?
Yeah, it's okay. Across the board.
It seems like one of them is higher than the other, and I can't remember which one.
Well, it can vary with different kinds, but in general, you want that above the ground. And the reason for that is you don't want the roots from the scion, that is whatever variety was grafted on top, to put out roots, because then you're going to lose the benefit of the rootstock. And if the rootstock, if it's like, say, an apple, and the rootstock is to cause a smaller size of the tree, we might call that a semi-dwarf or a dwarfing size tree, you will lose that benefit if you don't have that rootstock or that bud side graft union above the ground. The other detriment that can happen is if you have that in the soil, sometimes you get problems in that graft union. You'll get some rot going on there, or some insects like the woolly apple aphid can especially attack that graft union if it's down moist or against the soil. And so just keeping that up above ground is very important. But again, you can plant that containerized tree anytime you can get in and work the soil. And as far as pruning it, you know, I've been to many different fruit grower field days and pruning demonstrations, and it's amazing to me always how much they recommend to prune off young trees. They basically take it down to a whip.
Cut
off. So if you've got some feathers, some limbs starting to come off, they would prune it right there to remove all of that and start over shaping the tree, training the tree into the shape that they want. And if you don't, you know, pruning fruit trees is a whole other topic, and you should really get Dr. Brent Black to come in and talk about that on this program. But if you don't know about pruning fruit trees, you want to make sure you get some good information on that. There are a number of extension publications about pruning fruit trees available on our USU Extension website.
So let's mention that address, extension.usu.edu, mm-hmm. And then where do they go from there? Is there a gardening section that shows up automatically?
There is, or you can just go to... Even within that, there's a fruit-oriented website that's fruit.usu.edu, and that has some fact sheets, publications on pruning. Also, again, if you have never pruned fruit trees before, really recommend that you check with your local extension office and see if they're going to have a pruning field day
or
something.
And they'll be going on right now.
Yeah, this is the time that they're going on. So it'd be really good for you to attend one and get some information. Because you prune apple trees differently than you prune fruit peach trees. And so it's hard to explain that in a simple way on the air. It's really best to get some more information.
Well, our next caller is Margaret from Vernal. Hi, Margaret. How can we help?
Good morning. I just wanted to make a comment. I've already got crocuses out and seen bees on them, both yellow ones and purple ones. And I believe a number of my friends have told me they've got their daffodils coming up.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm jealous. We haven't seen any crocus like yet here in Logan yet.
Well, yeah, mine are all, the color's fading on them now. They're in a sunny spot. I think that's probably what it is. Well, I just thought I'd let you know.
But that's a good point that honeybees do, that any of those early blooming flowers like that, they really take advantage of them. They're so very important because there's not much else out there for them to eat this time of year.
Yes.
Great. Thank you, Margaret. Bye-bye. Well, we've reached the halfway point of our program. You're listening to Access Utah. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist, and she'll be here with us through the 10 o'clock hour. So if you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the toll-free number is 800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or go to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and you'll see the Access Utah link. So stay tuned. We have just a couple of minutes here, and then we'll be back with Diane Alston for the rest of the hour.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
When winter arrives in Utah, a number of our bird species hit the road, some flying thousands of miles to Mexico and Central America in search of a warm winter home. But there is one notable bird that actually migrates to Utah in the winter, the bald eagle. In general, birds migrate because of seasonal food shortages. Think of the hummingbirds that rely on flower nectar and insects, which Utah cannot provide in winter, but which are abundant other times of the year. The same is true for bald eagles, whose main food source is fish. Winter comes on strong in Alaska and Canada, freezing lakes, ponds, and all but the strongest flowing rivers. So the birds travel to seek out the relatively mild winters found farther south. One of the largest birds of prey you'll see in our Utah skies, a mature bald eagle can have a wingspan of 6 to 8 feet and stand almost 3 feet tall. Only the golden eagle rivals it in size. Pairs are thought to mate for life, and they are also responsible for the largest nests of any bird in North America. One record-setting abode measured 9 feet wide, 20 feet deep, and weighed more than 2 tons. And to think, we almost lost this incredible species. Since DDT and hunting heavily affected bald eagle numbers in the early half of the 20th century, the birds have made a truly remarkable comeback. From a low point, around 4,000 individuals in the lower 48 states, they are now thought to number in the tens of thousands and have been removed from the threatened and endangered species lists. Perhaps as their comeback continues, Utah will once again see these majestic animals make their massive nests here, fishing in our many rivers and lakes year-round. For now, though, aside from a few rare exceptions, bald eagle enthusiasts will have to make the most of their short winter stay. To observe bald eagles, consider a visit to the Great Salt Lake Nature Center at Farmington Bay. Every year, the bay plays host to hundreds of eagles from November to March, and while this milder-than-usual winter has brought in fewer numbers of eagles, you may still be able to catch a glimpse. They will likely be headed north later this month, however, so don't delay. And be sure to keep your ears tuned in to the bald eagle's haunting song. Thank you to the Rocky Mountain Power Foundation for supporting the research and development of this Wild About Utah topic. For the Stokes Nature Center and Wild About Utah, this is Andrea Liberator.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Hello, welcome back to the second half of Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me until 10 o'clock is Diane Alston, USU's Extension Entomologist. Our toll-free number is 800-826-1495, or you can go online and send us an email question. Go to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and you'll see Access Utah. We have our next caller is Kristen in Logan. Hi, Kristen. How can we help?
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for taking my call. My question is, I've been learning about the benefits of magnesium and how our food is actually lacking magnesium because of all of the synthetic fertilizers. Is there a cover crop that I can use to help bump up the magnesium in my soil?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I don't know. There are certainly again, different kinds of plants can release different kinds of compounds when they're tilled into the soil. I don't know if there's anything in particular that can actually add magnesium to the soil. I mean, plants may have magnesium in them, but whether that actually translates into building up the magnesium in the soil, I'm not the right person to ask. I'm an entomologist, not a soil scientist. I have not heard of that, so my guess is that there isn't some easy plant out there that can be done, but I don't know for sure.
Kristen, I've been doing a little research on this, and I'm just kind of in the early stages of that. So let me keep doing that because I know who this Kristen is. So I'm going to I'll follow up with you.
Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate it. I've been doing some research and just kind of hit a wall on what we can do to pump up that magnesium level. And so I realized you're an entomologist, but I thought, oh, maybe she'll have a thought. But thank you so much
so
for
you haven't,
my call.
Your own research hasn't found anything?
I haven't. I actually am going to put a call in to some soil specialists in California to see if they can help me, because that magnesium is crucial for our bodies. And we're just getting less and less of that from our food. So it's something that I really want to learn how to pump up in my garden to make it at optimal magnesium levels for my family.
Well, please do let me know what you find out.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And our next caller is John in Logan. Hi, John.
Hello. Good morning. Thanks for the show. I really appreciate it. I like to listen to it every week. I have a question about red currant. I put in one a couple of years ago, and each year now, the leaves are just curled and blistered, and it's painful to look at this plant. I still get some fruit off of it, but I wondered if there's anything I can do for the aphid. I think they're an aphid, but
You're
I'm
correct.
Not sure. I wondered if Diane could help me out with that.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, that is the currant aphid, very common. You grow currant around here, at least any of the cultivated currants. It's interesting, I don't tend to see the aphids really on the wild currants, you know, the golden wild currants. The leaves on those are smaller, and maybe they're just different enough that the aphid doesn't like them. But certainly the cultivated currants seem to be very attractive to the current aphid. So yes, there are some simple things you can do. When the leaves are still, you know, just opened up and they're still fairly young, that's usually when the aphid starts moving in.
I see.
And then once they roll and kind of buckle up those leaves, then they're somewhat protected from predators and things looking for them. So before you get to that puckering, buckling stage on the leaves, you can use a very simple insecticidal soap to wash off the leaves of the plant. And that's really helpful. And you'll probably need to do that several times. But if you can do that early on and reapply that every 5 days for two or three times, I think you'll really see a much reduced amount of the current aphid.
Very good. Thank you very much. I have some of that soap, so I'll try it out this year.
Great. Thanks, John.
Yeah,
thank
just
you.
Make sure you get the undersides of the leaves well. That's where they hang out.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye.
Now, I'm curious, where do these current aphids overwinter?
Where do they overwinter? Yeah.
I mean, can you put a dormant oil on these?
I don't think that these overwinter. Dioecious are the kinds that move back and forth between different kinds of plants, and that they lay their eggs on the woody plant. I'm not sure if the current aphid is overwintering on the currant itself or if it's on some other plants that it's moving in. So
will
we'll
it hurt the currant if I'm out spraying my other fruit trees?
I
might
so.
As well
no.
put this delayed
no,
dormant oil
so.
On the currants.
Yeah, give it a try and see if that helps.
Okay. Our next caller, you're popular today, is Pat from Logan. Hi, Pat. How can we help?
Well, first I have a comment on the fertilization. She's looking for... magnesium or manganese? But the years ago, I was concerned. I had young children, and I read that zinc was lacking in our diet. So I investigated and read up on it, and found that pig manure was high in zinc. And so I went out to Newton and hauled in a couple truckloads of pig manure, which made me popular with my neighbors. But might be one solution. Get what kinds of manures are higher different minerals.
Okay, that's a good suggestion.
But I was calling mostly because I was a certified arborist for years, and I remember back when I was studying plant science, reading modern arboriculture and publications by UC Davis on plant growth. To the extension people and being told that there's the
Pat, you're cutting out. We're
oh
yeah
oh
okay
out.
There you are. Now we hear you again.
Okay, let me go more towards the source of the phone system. The anyway, when I was younger, I was studying plant science and such, and I learned how to prune. And at that time, the Extension Service was saying if you took a 1-year whip of an apple, you should cut it to 18 inches high to make it branch. This is, of course, is contrary to anyone who actually prunes trees and studies them, because that creates a hormonal response, and you get a half dozen or more little tiny branches shooting straight up, trying to replace the whip. And in the book, Modern Arboriculture, it showed pictures of if you let the whip have side branches, they grow naturally. And by the third year, you have a nicely formed tree, and what you're doing is thinning some of the side branches and going to either, you know, modified central leader or whatever, you know, shape tree you want. And so at that point, the Extension Service was completely wrong in what they were advising. And I was kind of concerned when I hear someone saying to cut off branches and reduce it to a whip. Is that what I understood?
Well, I can tell you this is what the fruit growers in Utah County do.
They do.
They cut it back to a whip.
Is it about 36 inches? Is that
30? It depends on what kind of fruit tree and how you're going to be harvesting that tree. If you're if it's a tart cherry and you're going to be mechanically harvesting it with a shaker, you want a higher trunk, a taller trunk, because you got to have room to get that equipment in it. If you're growing a semi-dwarf apple tree and you're trying to keep the height of that tree down, then you will cut it shorter. But that is pretty much what the fruit growers in Utah County are doing. At least that's what they show us on the tour. So, I'm not a pomologist, so I'm not going to talk about the hormonal side of it. But that is what fruit growers are doing.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I can certainly see, you know, the different trees and peaches and apples and cherries are all pruned very differently. And if you're doing a commercial orchard, you want something that's like a hedge. You can run a tractor through, and, you know, because you have 1,000 acres and a crew working off a machine. If you want a backyard tree, that might not be, you know, exactly what you want. Because all the local nurseries take their 2-year-old apples and they top them. They top all their whips. And so you're saying this one, they cut off the side branches and leave the whip in general. That's interesting. But I encourage anyone to investigate it
definitely
further.
Definitely.
The goals of someone who's going to have, you know, a crew marching down with a tractor in between rows of hedge-grown fruit trees isn't what you're going to do in your
You're right. I'm not going to be able to fit a tractor in my backyard garden.
That's right.
Well, you want a pleasant, shaped tree. And the problem is that people plant too large a tree, and they should try and pay attention. If they want an 8-foot tree, then find from a reputable nursery a rootstock that'll grow a 6 or 8 foot tree.
You know, and that is such a key, because sometimes we tend to go to a big box store is good for certain things, but it's usually gardening is not one of them.
I agree.
I tend to like to go to more local sources because they know what grows there.
Right, and they're going to have varieties and tree species that are appropriate. I've had so many people ask me about blueberries that are sold at big box stores and how come they don't do well here. And I said, well, don't buy a blueberry and plant it here. Our soil is too alkaline.
Yeah. I have had good luck with blackberries that I got downtown.
Yeah, blackberries are
doing blackberries okay. Do well.
From a local, well-established nursery. I won't specify which one, I guess, on air. I guess I could. I'm not sure the policies on recommending nurseries. but let us say not a big box store.
Exactly.
I would say I got for years the Carlton nursery ones from their nurseries professional magazine, and different apple varieties. I prune mostly apples nowadays. I'm semi-retired in that. But their advice for like Braeburn is don't touch the top growth for 7 years. If you don't have fruit pulling the top branches over, drop crotch to the nearest side branch. And that's an example of specific variety pruning. If you prune your Jonathan's hard, they're very susceptible to disease, and you'll weaken the tree. Red Delicious, on the other hand, you can whack fairly hard. So it's a the people should be very hesitant when they get out there with their loppers.
Well, you brought up some very important points. Thank you for bringing them up.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Pat. Our next caller is Abby in Ogden. Hi, Abby. How can we help?
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I have got a problem every year in about early to mid-June. An entire crop of caterpillars kind of comes out, and they completely defoliate every single tree on my property. Not fruit trees. They're mostly box elder trees. And I'm luckily enough, the trees reflush a new set of leaves. But I'm just wondering if there's something I should be doing now to, like, maybe take care of the eggs before they come out.
Okay, so this is just strictly on your box elder trees.
No, they actually take every single... I mostly have box elder trees,
oh, okay.
But they actually defoliate every
single
tree on the property, yep.
Okay, so do you have any oaks on your property?
Maybe one or two.
Okay.
But there's lots of oaks on the neighboring property,
okay.
Like scrub oak.
The scrub oak that you have,
yep,
in that area. Okay. So my best guess, and I'm pretty sure this is right, is the cankerworm. It's very common. The scrub oak is one of its preferred hosts here in northern Utah, and that's generally where you see it associated with, is areas where the scrub oak are on the foothills on the hillsides. So there's two different kinds. There's a spring and a fall, and the name refers to when the eggs hatch. And so one overwinters as the adult moth and one overwinters as the egg. So the best thing, I think, in terms of trying to give more general recommendations without having identified specifically which cankerworm you have, is that the best thing to do is when you first start to see the little tiny caterpillars. So, you know, we have to go out and look because you don't want to wait till they're all big and defoliating the tree. But when you start to see the first little ones, you can use some insecticides that are very specific to caterpillars and are not toxic to other kinds of insects. One of the best choices is insecticide called BT, which stands for Bacillus thuringiensis, which is the name of the natural bacterium, and it produces a natural toxin that is very specific to caterpillars. The pH of the gut of the caterpillar is high, and that causes this toxin to break down and have activity on it. You do have to cover the leaves of the trees, however, and so if you have a lot of trees, that can be problematic that way. But it's very, very effective.
So would you look to where they're starting out, and can you just spray this as you see the problem starting to develop in certain areas, and will that,
yes,
keep it from spreading?
It can, yes. And that's why I asked her about the oaks. My guess is that they're probably coming in on the oaks, and that's then moving into some of the other trees in her yard. And so I would focus on the scrub oak or the area near the scrub oak as the primary, maybe early site that they're the most problem on.
Now, with this, go ahead.
How would I deal with trees that are, like, 80 feet tall? Because some of the box elders are, like, I can't reach them with my hose and sprayer and stuff.
Yeah, that makes it problematic. So I wish there was something better to recommend. The ones that overwinter as moths, you can use some sticky bands on the trunks of the trees. The females actually are flightless. They don't have wings, interesting for a moth, and they have to climb up into the trees to lay their eggs. But I would hesitate to say that's going to solve all your problems. I think the BT spray is probably the better way to go, focusing on, again, those areas over by the scrub oak, or if you can identify kind of the early trees that start to get attacked first and where these little caterpillars show up. I mean, the little tiny caterpillars show up. You do have to, again, get good coverage because they have to eat it. They have to ingest it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Good luck to you, Abby.
Okay, all right, thanks, bye.
All right, bye-bye. Our next caller is Keith in St. George. Hi, Keith, how can we help?
I just had a comment on that spray.
Mm-hmm.
We have a sprayer that'll shoot up about 40 feet, a water sprayer that takes a solution out of your bottle. We mix up four hot peppers, a clove of garlic. We put them in a blender. Then you add just a touch of soap and spray up there. Spray your leaves. And we've got rid of the ones that strip your cherry trees. We've got rid of the tent
caterpillar is what you have problems with, especially in your area, yes.
We don't have any on our property. And because we've sprayed and they'll stay gone for 3 or 4 years.
So you said it's a teaspoon of cloves?
No, a clove of garlic.
Oh, sorry, a clove of garlic.
4 hot peppers. And you buy the bottle of hot peppers. Grind those up in a mixer. Then you strain them through a sock to get rid of all the chunks.
So how much water?
The hose is going to add your water.
Oh, okay, so you're just...
Basically.
Okay. That's just the amount of stock solution that you use.
Okay.
Yeah, you just add enough moisture to fill up your mixing bowl on your mixer or your... Anyway, that doesn't cost anything, and it works like a champ.
That's great.
Wow, great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, the peppers have the capsaicin. That's that's what makes it hot. And that has been shown to be an insecticide. It tends to be more of a repellent than an actual killer, a side killing. But if that you find that's working, that's wonderful.
Well, on the cherries, we had a huge cherry tree. When we would spray it, we'd come back 2 days later, and you could see where you had missed. But as soon as you spray it, you just quit eating.
Well, that's wonderful. And the tent caterpillars are a real problem down in that area.
Oh, yeah. Well, I hate to see Zion National Park every year. They don't spray. And this would just cure the problem, but,
Well, you should let them know.
I have.
Thank you very much, Keith.
Bye-bye.
All right, take care. Well, we've pretty well reached the end of our time.
It's just flown by.
It does. Well, and I love all the questions from our listeners. So thank you all for calling in. You've been listening to Access Utah. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist, and she'll be with us the second Monday of every month through the growing season.
I'm looking forward to it.
And I've got plenty more questions to get back to next time.
Yeah, we didn't even get through our list here.
Exactly. So again, thank you for listening to Access Utah.
A beautiful landscape can feed your body as well as your mind and spirit when you include some edible ornamental plants. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Keep a few strawberries within reach of your meals by growing them in hanging baskets or containers. Or find a patch of sunny ground and use them as a ground cover. The flowers, fruit, and fall color provide seasons of beauty. Hops will quickly cover a fence or trellis and provide hops for the home brewer. Keep the pruners handy to keep this vigorous grower in check. Or grow your favorite beans and peas or those with colorful flowers and fruit on a fence or trellis. Use raspberries to make an impenetrable hedge and provide screening. Regular pruning will keep these spreaders under control, producing lots of fruit, and usually pest-free. Add a bit of edible living art to your landscape with espaliered apples, pears, plums, or cherries. These beauties provide flowers, fruit, and fall color for you to enjoy. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Coming up on Utah Public Radio, performance today at 11 o'clock, at 1 o'clock, exploring music, and at 4 o'clock, all things considered.